We are now ready to hear an argument from petitioners in the case of Plastex Incorporated and others versus U.S. Steel Corporation.
May it please the court. My name is Larry Holm, and I represent Fiberex, which was the plaintiff below. Plastex is also a petitioner in this court, was one of the co-defendants below, and had a cross-action for indemnity against the primary defendant, which was U.S. Steel, that is the respondent. I'm given 20 minutes to argue, and then Mr. Higgins will argue for 10 minutes for Plastex. There are basically two points before this court, having to do with the burden of proof and a breach of warranty and the standard review under the standard set forth by this court in Poole versus Ford Motor. First, I want to explain what the case was about in trial. I represent a mom-and-pop organization that builds fiberglass swimming pools. And they do this by taking fiberglass as it exists raw and combining it with a product called polyester resin. This resin serves two purposes. The first purpose is to give the fiberglass rigidity and strength so that it will hold its shape whenever it's put to whatever purpose it is, whether it be a boat or a swimming pool. The second purpose is to allow multiple layers of the fiberglass to stick together. The reason that's important is in building a pool, you take a mold, cover it with wax so that the fiberglass you put on top of it doesn't stick to it, and mold the fiberglass with the resin to that mold, and the resin then hardens because you catalyze it. You put another substance into it that catalyzes it. And then over the course of time, it'll harden. But you can't just do this process one time, because one coat or one layer of fiberglass does not give the pool enough strength to perform its function that is to hold the water. People that use it as a swimming pool. So you have to do multiple layers, or what they call laminates, of the fiberglass. So the second quality of resin, that is the liquid that you use to lay these fiberglass pieces together, is to bind or adhere one layer to the next layer. And that's what this lawsuit is about. The resin that U.S. Steel sold to Plastex, who was the distributor, and then was sold to Fiberex, which was the user, did not perform that function. Several pools, after installation, some before installation, started coming apart between the laminates. And there's abundant evidence in the record from all parties concerned that would render the pools unfit. They could not be sold or used as a swimming pool because of that. It makes them defective. It was our contention in the trial court that the failure of the resin to bond the layers of the laminates of fiberglass together was a breach of warranty. The jury so found, and the Court of Appeals has reversed and remanded for a new trial on the basis that in order to sustain the jury verdict, it was necessary for Fiberex to offer proof that why that occurred. In other words, they are saying that the Court of Appeals below is saying that in order to sustain a jury verdict finding breach of implied warranty of fitness, that we have to show to the jury or offer evidence as to why that happened. Now, resin is a very complex chemical, and in order to make it harden, it comes in a liquid form. In order to make it harden, you have to add catalyst to it. And then a chemical reaction occurs, and it changes, and it becomes hard. We were unable to prove, and we'll always be unable to prove, exactly why this resin did not do that. There were very many explanations offered at trial as to why, possibilities, but no one can conclusively, nor will ever be able to conclusively show why it did not work. It's our position that why is not the question. The question is, did it perform or did it not? And the evidence, if not clearly supported the record, is conclusive that it did not perform the function it was intended to perform. That is, to bind the laminates together. Now, there was a case decided by a court of appeals, another court of appeals, Dresser, cited in all the briefs and in the opinion, where I think it was the Beaumont court, I'm not sure of that, stated that in a breach of warranty case, it is not necessary to prove why a particular product fails. The issue is whether or not it was fit for its ordinary purpose, and that can be proved by showing it does not work. Also, we had further proof, not that just that the layers of laminates came apart, but that they were properly applied. The jury was asked a special issue about the application procedures of Fibrex, and they found, based on all the evidence of a 2.5-week trial, that the application procedures were proper. So we had additional evidence to support a finding of the jury that the breach of warranty was committed by the respondent in the case. Now, the court below tried to distinguish the Dresser case. Now, really, when you read the opinion, you can't make up your mind whether or not they're saying it was wrong or whether they were trying to distinguish it. I think they first said it was wrong in respect to what the burden of proof is for a breach of warranty. But Dresser is right. Since the applications have been granted, we have done additional research into other jurisdictions that have considered the question of whether or not in a breach of warranty case, the proof of a specific defect is required, or whether or not you sustain your burden of proof by merely demonstrating that the product does not work as it was intended to work.
Counsel, I'm familiar with 23 of the jurisdictions. How many did you research?
Well, you beat me, Your Honor. I only had 16 that we found that stated specifically that you do not have to prove a specific defect in order to show a breach of warranty. We also found 10 others that I think by reading the case you can conclude that that was the holding of the court. I would request the commission report to submit a post-submission brief on the out-of-state jurisdictions that have addressed this issue.
How long will it take you then?
I could have it to you next week, Your Honor.
All right. You have 1 week to file it, and it's a week enough to get a response in.
Your Honor, we do have a Thanksgiving break in between here, and I think that staying a week from today, next Wednesday was actually only 2 in the office days left after this.
No, that's what he's asking for.
Well, we would like to have an additional 7 days, Your Honor.
Yes, that's what I was offering. All right.
We'll have it to the court on Wednesday, Your Honor. But I think it's clear when you review secondary sources about proof of breach of warranty that all the jurists and the people that analyze questions like this can agree that you do not have to prove why a defect exists.
I know before you go on, I know you're going to supplement. You said you found 16 jurisdictions that hold there's no need to show the specific defect, and then you said 11 others, and I didn't get the 11. What the
well,
other 11 others?
Your Honor, I'm referring to a memo that I have before me that says that these other 11 cases don't specifically hold that, but by reading of the case, you can conclude that the court was or had considered it as a foregone conclusion that proof of a specific defect was not required. That's not our burden in this case. The Court of Appeals erroneously made it our burden. And the case that they cite, the principal case they rely upon, the Langley case, Procter & Gamble versus Langley, that's the case where the lady put hair dye on her hair and all her hair fell out. They rely on that case, but in that case it was conclusively shown that she misapplied the product. Here, that was what the whole trial was about. Everyone conceded that there was delamination, that the layers had come apart. But the trial went on for 2.5 weeks about whether or not the application procedures of Fibrex were properly done. And I'll admit to this court, there was a conflict in the evidence about that. But the jury resolved that conflict in our favor. Yet the Court of Appeals has decided that because we did not prove the specific reason why the laminates came apart, then we must lose and reverse and remand for a new trial.
Did they not hold it that that finding was against the great weight of the preponderance of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. They held that, but they based that ruling upon the standard that we must prove a specific defect. Now, that's confusing in and of itself to me, because if it was our standard to prove a specific defect, there was no proof of that. What specifically caused this delamination to come apart? There's no way to prove it. Now, if that were in fact the standard that they were applying, it should have been rendered, because that proof was not in there. What was in there was circumstantial proof. And I want to move to that, because I think this is where the Court of Appeals opinion is in grievous error, because they held that proof of a specific defect could be shown circumstantially by showing, first, that it didn't work, and secondly, that it didn't work, that the reason it didn't work wasn't because of something that the application process caused. That's what the whole trial was about. In reviewing the evidence, the Court of Appeals below cited all the proper cases and the standards to be applied, but then wrote a footnote about what they were actually going to do. That footnote is on page 9 of the opinion. It's the second footnote. And they say in that footnote, more precisely, an insufficient evidence point, that's the no evidence point too, I think they called it the insufficiency evidence point, requires only considerations of the evidence tending to support a fact. Well, a great weight point requires consideration of all evidence. If they'd stopped there, that's the right standard. That's what the court said in Poole. But then they continue. As a practical matter, however, both points are treated alike by Texas courts. Thus, we shall simultaneously apply our analysis and disposition to both the insufficient, meaning no evidence, and the great weight points. And they cited Judge Cornelius for that proposition.
Are you reading from the slip opinion or from the Southwest Reporter opinion?
I'm looking at the slip opinion, Your Honor. It's the second footnote.
Southwest Reporter is on page 631.
I don't have it in front of me. I don't know the page number. Thank you, Your Honor. Well, that's not the way you do it. But when you read the opinion...
Well, before you go on, under standard of review, and I don't know how it appears on the slip opinion, it says, in reviewing factual insufficiency contentions, we consider all of the evidence in the record that is relevant to the fact being challenged, including any evidence contrary to the judgment. Now, that is a correct statement of the law, isn't it?
That's right, Your Honor.
They know what you're quarreling about.
I'm not sure what they did, Your Honor, but they recited all the proper standards, but then they wrote that footnote and said, as a practical matter, the points are treated alike, thus we shall simultaneously apply our analysis to both points. But what they did was, is they disregarded the evidence that supported the jury's findings and treated as true the evidence that was presented by U.S. Steel. They applied the absolute reverse of what they should have done in the case. The only way for this court to see that is to have to review the evidence. And I'd like to point out specific examples of how they did that. They said throughout the opinion, they repeated it several times, that we had to show evidence of proper applications. But they never recited the evidence that we did that. As I said, this was a 2.5-week trial. That's what it was all about. There were instances in the record. Mr. Yarbrough, who was the man that put these pools together, was in charge of that. He testified that the application process was proper. That's on page 67 and 68 of the record. Mr. Smith is the Plastec's representative and owner of Plastec's, who had observed the application process. He testified on page 278 that he had watched them lay up these pools, that is, put them together, and that he was familiar with their techniques. In his opinion, the proper, proper application techniques were being followed. Mr. Erickson, the expert that was hired by Plastex, reviewed all of the depositions in the record that had been created in the pretrial discovery about the application process, and he testified both in deposition and live at trial that the application process was appropriate. Now, it's frustrating when a court of appeals says you must prove this, but you have no proof of it when the proof is in the record. Now, when they don't detail that in the opinion, there's no way for this court to know that they're not applying the right standard. And they didn't in this case. Another example, and you can tell this from the opinion itself. On page 29 of the slip opinion, Your Honor, and I don't have the cite to the published opinion. It says, all parties called experts to testify, not one, including those called by FiberX, parentheses, with the exception of Yarborough, and he was the principal witness for FiberX, testified that any factor in all reasonable probability was the cause of the delamination. Well, he did. He testified to that. He said in all probability it was the resin that caused the delamination, not the application process. But the court doesn't give that testimony, although they acknowledge it's there. Why does the court say that Mr. Yarbrough's testimony should be disregarded? It supports the jury's verdict. What's manifestly unjust about it? What insight do they have into
it? 636 of the Southwestern Court of Appeals.
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Piece of evidence that didn't get into the Court of Appeals opinion is Mr. Smith, representative of Plastex, who's familiar with application of resins and how they're supposed to bond laminates together, took a sample of the delaminated portion of one of these pools, and he took it back with him, and he said, I laminated another piece to it the way it should have been done, using all the proper application techniques. And he testified that it, too, delaminated, came completely apart, showing no evidence of bond. Now, that was direct evidence that the resin was failing. It was not appropriate for making big pools where you have to have that bond. That's not in the Court of Appeals opinion. In some instances, the Court of Appeals opinion disregards evidence. They stated in their opinion that there was no proof that during the course of the trial, there was evidence that there was odd lot material added to this resin. Resins are made in big vats, and it's almost like baking a cake. And when they put the resin in, sometimes they throw in some what they called odd lot. What it was just throwaways that they were using to bulk it up, to give it the bulk that they needed to make these resins. And there was a dispute as to whether or not that could have been a cause or was a cause of the delamination. And there was evidence that it could have been a cause. The court said, but there was no evidence that that was ever received by FiberX. And what they said was there was no written proof of that. But there was oral testimony that there was. That every one of the batches of resin that had this odd lot in it was shipped at some point in time to FiberX. And I can cite the court to the portions of the record. It's page 281, I'm sorry, page 452 of the record. Mr. Smith testified that FiberX was a large enough customer that they would have gotten a shipment of every single batch of resin that he received from U.S. Steel, and it was shown by record that he received batches of resin that had an odd lot in it. Now, the big point that U.S. Steel makes about this in their line of defense in it is that we can't show which batch the resin came from that went in to make the pool that got delaminated. There was more than one. There was 34 of them that we sought damages on. But the proof was that every pool was made with U.S. Steel resin. And we can't tell, there's no way for us to trace which particular vat it came out of. But that's certainly not our burden. I've never understood that argument, and I know that they're going to make it here today.
Was there any resin from any other source other than U.S. Steel?
No, not to make pools. There were resins sent to them to make tools, but not pools. Okay? And it's clear in the record, it's cited in our brief, that the resins were used, only U.S. Steel resins were used to make the pools at all times. Now, I know my time's now expired, so I'll defer to the counsel.
It pleases the court, Roger Higgins on behalf of Petitioner Plastex. The issue presented by Plastex petition is fairly simple. U.S. Steel contends that if they are successful on their appeal as to Fiberex, the plaintiff below, that Plastex should be required to go back down to the trial court and retry not just the issues regarding the recovery of attorney's fees from U.S. Steel, but all issues asserted by Fiberex against Plastex at the trial below. That was the holding of the Court of Appeals, and U.S. Steel asked its court to support that holding. We feel that neither the facts of the case nor the current state of the law in Texas support that ruling. You've already heard some of the background to this, but very simply stated, Fiberex sued Plastex and U.S. Steel. Plastex cross-claimed against U.S. Steel for indemnity and contribution and its attorney's fees. At trial, based upon the verdict, the trial court entered a take-nothing judgment as to Fiberex's claims against Plastex. And under Section 17.555 of the DTPA, awarded Plastex its attorney's fees over and from U.S. Steel. The Court of Appeals, this was based upon the evidence. The evidence was pretty clear. Plastex is a true supplier. It got the product in sealed containers, sent it out in sealed containers. The evidence showed that we didn't change the labels or the instructions. A true middleman situation. And based upon that, the court entered a take-nothing judgment. And based upon other issues, that take-nothing judgment as to the plaintiff and granted us our attorney's fees. The Court of Appeals wrongfully held that if U.S. Steel gets a second bite of the apple as to the claims of Fiberex against it, I have to go back down and retry all the entire case as it stood when it went to trial. Although Fiberex has not challenged the take-nothing judgment against Plastex. And this is contrary to the general rule applied in Texas, and we cite this in our brief. The general rule is a reversal of a judgment as to a party appealing therefrom will not justify reversal against other non-appealing parties. In essence, the claim against Plastex by Fiberex is not the subject of an appeal. And under the general rule of Lockhart versus Snyder, which we just cited and which is followed in many cases, the case should not be reversed as to the issues of Fiberex against Plastex. Now, U.S. Steel will point to an exception. I do not have the benefit of an argument or analysis by the Court of Appeals. They simply did not address this issue in their opinion. They did not even address Plastex in their opinion. And in fact, I was identified as an attorney for Fiberex in the opinion when I was not at the court below. I am an attorney for Plastex. Exception is that when the rights of the parties are intertwined and dependent upon each other, the non-appealing party might get sent back down to the court, even though he doesn't appeal, if it will somehow prejudice the rights of another party or even that party's rights. That exception simply does not apply. We're not talking about, let me back up a little bit. I think that they're confused when they say that exception applies. We're not talking about intertwined facts. There's no doubt that the facts are intertwined here. We're talking about intertwined rights, and the rights are not intertwined. Our seeking attorney's fees from U.S. Steel is not dependent upon our liability to Fiberex. That was well established by the Supreme Court in the case of Swofford versus Viewcaps back in 1981, in which this court held that in order to recover your attorney's fees under Section 17.55 of the 555 of the DPPA, you need not prove or you may not have liability as defendant one to the plaintiff in order to get your attorney's fees from defendant two who caused the plaintiff's liability. In other words, my right to my client's right to recover attorney's fees is not dependent under Swofford versus ViewCaps on liability to FiberX, the plaintiff. All that matters is that U.S. Steel, the other defendant against whom I'm seeking my attorney's fees, is responsible for the loss of FiberX. FiberX is not seeking to retry the issues against Plastex. Therefore, because these are not independent in the, because my liability to FiberX is not dependent upon, or the right to recover attorney's fees from U.S. Steel is not dependent upon liability to FiberX, these are not interwoven. They're not dependent, as the exception states. And I think if we look at the cases cited by U.S. Steel in their brief, in which they try to argue that these are interwoven, we can see a clear distinction in this situation.
Are you still seeking attorney's fees with U.S. Steel?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe under Swofford versus ViewCaps, we are entitled to do that without being
in a separate trial?
No. I think the way it would work is the remand would relate solely to the issue, almost as a matter of law. If FiberX recovers against U.S. Steel,
you get attorney's
fees. I get attorney's fees.
If they do not recover, though, you get nothing.
Exactly. I'd like to have some issues to argue. I still get my attorney's fees, but I don't think I can construe the issues that were submitted to do that.
If FiberX doesn't recover under the DTPA against U.S. Steel, how could you argue that you're entitled to attorney's fees?
No, I don't think I can in this situation. Given the issues that were submitted, I don't have separate findings sufficient to do that.
Well, if you agree, then you ought to be remanded for the limited purpose only of giving you the right to recover attorney's fees in the event that FiberX recovers from U.S. Steel.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, that is our position. We feel that, however, we should not be subject to the claims of FiberX, where they have shown no interest in asserting that on appeal. We already have basically a res judicata finding of take nothing as to Plastex. And as the court recognized in Swofford versus ViewCaps, I don't have to be liable to them to get my attorney's fees. And they're not dependent. I will just point to one case as an example of how they're misconstruing the case law regarding the exception to show a distinction. I think it can be dealt with fairly quickly. But in the Diamond Shamrock versus Wendt case, which they cite and rely upon, the plaintiff sued a manufacturer and a supplier, to make the case simple. The manufacturer was liable to the plaintiff, and the supplier was apparently vicariously liable to the plaintiff as well, because they were granted indemnity at the trial court level. Even though they were liable to the plaintiff, they were granted indemnity from the other defendant, the manufacturer. The manufacturer appealed, but the supplier didn't. The manufacturer successfully appealed, and the case was remanded. The court said, well, we can't let that judgment stand in favor of you, plaintiff, when the person who is passively liable, the indemnitor, if you will, or indemnity, if you will, the supplier, we can't let that judgment stand against him when the person who is actively liable, the manufacturer, the indemnitor, has gotten a reversal and a remand. We're not going to let that judgment between the plaintiffs stand. Totally two different situations. The supplier liability there to the plaintiff, and there was supplier liability to the plaintiff, was contingent upon, or as a result of, the manufacturer's acts. And that's evidenced by the indemnity situation between the manufacturer and supplier. And again, that shows interwoven rights. The other cases involve things like injunctions, where they say one party doesn't have to, where they've removed an injunction against several people, and they eliminate it as to all. It's very, very limited cases that the exception applies. There has to be truly independent rights. The rights here are not independent. The facts are, and that shouldn't be confused. In conclusion, Plastex requests that the court, if the case is remanded as between FiberX and U.S. Steel, that the court limit, pursuant to Rules 181 and 184, limit any remand to the question of attorney's fees. And that should be a question of law that's contingent upon whether or not FiberX recovers. We should not be exposed to liability to FiberX when they themselves do not seek it, and it's not required for our attorney's fees under 17.55.
What
Thank
happens
you.
If we should affirm the trial court judgment in favor of FiberX against
Clearly, it should be, the trial court judgment should be affirmed as to Plastex as well. There were no challenges.
Well, do you have your attorney's fees in that event?
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We are ready to hear arguments from respondents.
Would you present arguments from respondents?
May it please the court, I'm Judy Norris. I'm here today on behalf of Respondent U.S. Steel Corporation. We've got a number of issues that are before the court in both applications for writs of error that I'm here to respond to. The first issue, though, that I want to address, which I really don't believe has been fully addressed before the court, at least in the oral argument here today, is the key issue brought by Fibrex, and that's the breach of the implied warranty of merchantability. That's the first issue. It's under Article 2.314 of the UCC. As you will recall, to paraphrase that UCC provision, the plaintiff, in this case Fibrex, would have to show that the product in question, and again I emphasize the product in question, was unfit for its ordinary purposes at the time it left the manufacturer, U.S. Steel. And I don't think, I listened to Mr. Hallman, and I didn't hear him ever mention that once in his remarks to you. That's a key factor to remember when I go through some of the evidence. Because this is an evidence, a factual insufficiency of the evidence, and against the greater weight and preponderance of the evidence case. At the time the resin left U.S. Steel. That's the only way that there's any liability under a breach of implied warranty of merchantability. Put very succinctly, the evidence consisted of the following, shall we say, six facts. And I have cited these on pages 13 and 14 of my brief, and I give you the statement of facts references also, so that at a later day, rather than just referring to my general remarks, you can go back to the statement of facts and you have the specific evidence that I'm referring to. Fibrex bought some U.S. Steel resin from Plastex, but there were no records establishing which batches of U.S. Steel resin went from Plastex to Fibrex. None. Fibrex built some fiberglass swimming pools out of two kinds of resin, MR12-214 and MR12-265, during the time period that's in question here. That's the mid-1980, mid-1981. Well, at the time of trial, Fibrex dropped any claim about MR12-650 U.S. Steel resin, based its entire claim on MR12-214. And yet, as the justice indicated, there was indication in the evidence that MR12-214, the product in question, at least according to Fibrex's claim, was not the only resin that was being used to build pools during this time frame. Then we have over 100 pools being manufactured by Fibrex during this time. Fibrex claims about 34 of them delaminated. So they're not going to claim about problems with all of the MR12-214. They're claiming problems with only that resin that they used on those pools that delaminated.
214 a U.S. Steel product.
Yes, sir. We don't know which U.S. Steel resin batch was used on any pool that delaminated. You have to realize that when I say batch, that's a distinguishing feature as opposed to the general characterization of MR12-214. The batches are separate. Each one contains different ingredients. All that was required under the typical properties was that they react in certain ways. That's called the typical properties, and that was in evidence. In fact, I think I attached as Appendix C the technical information sheet, which gives you what U.S. Steel says its resin will do. However, we don't know which batch of resin that Fibrex used on any of the pools that delaminated.
Wait a minute, help me.
Sure.
You're losing me.
Okay.
I'm sure it's fault.
No, it's all of these facts.
It's my fault because I understood the case to be whether or not it was the U.S. Steel's resin that was being used and whether or not it worked or didn't work as the basis of a breach of warranty. What difference does it make which batch it's in and which batch it's not?
Because, Your Honor, it makes a big difference when you know that Fibrex has to prove that that resin was unfit at the time it left U.S. Steel. Not unfit at the time it's 3 years in the ground, Your Honor, The case law is clear that they have a burden of proof to show that it's unfit at the time it left U.S. Steel. And so therefore, in order to show that unfitness, you would have to go back to the batches.
Did they get a jury finding of that?
I'm sorry?
Did they get a jury finding of that, that it was defective at the time it left U.S. Steel?
They didn't get a jury finding on any defect, Your Honor, because they never presented any evidence as to defect.
Well, they proved it. They had evidence it didn't work.
No, they didn't. They had evidence that the pools did not, that the pools delaminated. They did not have evidence that the resin did not work. Because as you see, what happened was that Fibrex could never tell you how the resin that was used on the pools that delaminated was unfit. It could not tell you that.
Well, it didn't stick. That's what they showed, wasn't it?
That's right, Your Honor. And then the last point that I mentioned in my brief is the key point, because there are a multitude of reasons in the record, in the evidence that is addressed in the appellate court decision, and I have cited at least 14 of those different references on the statement of facts in my brief as to why the delamination occurred, other than what Fibrex was claiming.
Well, what did the jury answer? I mean, somehow they got to get you into the lawsuit.
The jury answered, Your Honor, as I recall, these were jury issues 1 and 2, and I apologize because I don't have them in front of me, that the product in question was unfit for its ordinary purposes. And then the juror, special issue number 2, which Your Honors might know is not before this court, is the causation issue. This court has not granted writ on the points of error regarding causation.
Everything's before us, even though we indicated our special interest in certain things.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
They rely very heavily on Dresser. What is your response to Dresser?
Dresser, first of all, and unfortunately I believe that it is an unclear opinion. In Dresser, there was only one product, one specific identifiable product, that gauge. In Dresser, there was no evidence, possible or probable, no evidence of misuse by the plaintiff. There was no evidence that could be used, that the gauge could be used in any other way other than the way that that worker used it. In this case, you're dealing with resin, which is a chemical compilation, which has a multitude of uses by various manufacturers. There was an undisputed account of what went wrong in Dresser, and the court's opinion states that there was direct and circumstantial evidence of a defect. And they also rely, if you'll recall, on Conan, which is the one about the septic tank.
Yeah, that's the toilet case.
That's the where you've got the septic tank system in the front yard of the plaintiff. Again, in that case, where the court states that there was a determination through circumstantial evidence of a defect. Again, we still get back to that defect. That there was only one possible product, there was no evidence of misuse by the homeowners, there was an undisputed account of what went wrong, and there was evidence of the defect. Now, I believe that what has happened with Dresser is that the plaintiff, Fibrex, has latched on to one sentence in Dresser which refers to circumstantial evidence. And I believe, if Your Honor, it's interesting that Mr. Holman mentioned the fact that since the application, granting of the writ, has done some additional research, because I did some also on the other jurisdictions. I found 33 jurisdictions that required a showing of a defect. It's true that showing of the defect could be either by direct or circumstantial evidence, but you know how that circumstantial evidence was used in those cases? It's circumstantial evidence to show that the defect was in existence in the product at the time it left the manufacturer, because they say that the plaintiff cannot be put to the chore of proving by direct evidence that it was there at the time it left the manufacturer. So it can prove it by circumstantial evidence. And how does that circumstantial evidence work? Well, it works where they show that they bought a product, they show they used it correctly, and that's what these cases are holding. They put that burden on Fibrex. They show they used it correctly. They show that there are no intervening causes for the failure. And so therefore, the jury has an unmistakable inference. There are no leaps of speculation involved there that the defect was in existence at the time it left the manufacturer. They identify a defect. And in fact, we have cited to the court in our briefs several cases, including the Langley case that I believe Mr. Holman referred to, which states that where you have evidence of misuse and you have no explanation of how it was unfit, it's a leap of incredulity that the jury could come up with a finding based upon on sufficient evidence that there was that product was unfit. Actually, if you think about it, what FiberX's argument is kind of a bastardization of res ipsa loquitur. They are taking a negligence theory and trying to place it on the statutory UCC cause of action. They're saying the damages occurred, we recover. Well, we don't know what was it about the product that you bought that was wrong. How do we know that what happened that when you applied the resin wasn't the cause of this? But no, what they want to say is, oh, the damage occurred, we recover. And in fact, even in their briefs, they say, well, what the Court of Appeals has done is put a strict liability argument requirement on us. Well, as we all know, the strict liability standard was actually a standard that was derived in order to take away the contractual argument of no privity. It's actually an easier standard, perhaps, sometimes for a plaintiff to meet, but it still requires a showing of a defect. There's a case that we've cited, Ford versus Tidwell, in which the appellate court decision, and I believe that was an NRE decision, specifically said, this is a new car case. We've got many defects in this in the allegations. Some of the defects were pointed out, that and it was proven by evidence that they were existing in that car when it left the Ford Motor Company. Some of the defects, we don't know how they came up, but there's a bunch of evidence in the record that shows intervening causes, thereby making it insufficient evidence to negate the possibility of misapplication.
Ford is one of the three or four cases in Texas that conflicts with Gresson.
That's right. That's correct, Your Honor. Ford does. Langley does. I believe that there's one, American Trailer versus Medlin does. I believe Herbert versus Loveless does. And I really believe that what has happened in Dresser is that if you go back to the facts in Dresser, you see that Dresser still had direct and circumstantial evidence of a defect.
I'm confused by one thing that was said today. Is the Dresser rule, does it represent the majority or the minority rule in the rest of the country?
Well, it depends upon which party you want to talk to as to what the Dresser rule is, Your Honor. I don't believe that Dresser stands for the proposition that all you have to do is show that I had damage occur and that's all I need to show.
I assume it stands that all you have to do is show that damage has occurred and that's it.
I think that by far, Your Honor, and of course this will be addressed in the supplemental briefs, but I believe by far it is the minority rule. In fact, I found sufficient evidence in the UCC case digest that they strictly, specifically say res ipsa loquitur theories have no place in breach of implied warranty cases. Now what we need to do here is we have to get back to the basics of the evidence in this case. We've got an unknown product in question. It's not MR12214, it's the resin that was used on the pools that delaminated. We don't know which resin was used on the pools that delaminated.
Does it matter whether you know or not, as long as it's your resin?
Yes, Your Honor, it does, because it matters because the plaintiff has to show it was unfit. The only way they showed it was unfit was by saying, our pools delaminated.
What's wrong with that? I can't understand that.
Because, Your Honor, they have to show...
You tell me a car and you say, this is an automobile you can use. I get in the car, the wheels fall off, the motor won't work, it won't start. I don't know why. I don't care why. I just know you sold me a car and it doesn't work. Well, why isn't that a breach of warranty?
Well, Your Honor, in the example you just gave, you got in the car, but there were no other car... automotive repairmen working on that car in between the time you purchased it and you got in the car and turned on that wheel to show intervening causes for the problem.
I'm not raising that.
Well, that, Your Honor, is exactly the point. They have to show that it was unfit, defective at the time it left U.S. Steel.
How would a, as he called it, a mom and pop operation do that?
Well, Your Honor, that is their burden of proof.
I mean, when it leaves your plant, in what state? It's in a sealed container?
That's right, Your Honor. But how they do that is by keeping records to show what it is they used on pools.
They had no records. We were dealing in the dark. It was very difficult for U.S. How could they prove it? It was very difficult for U.S. Steel to come up with a way to disprove it, even though that wasn't our burden of proof, because they couldn't give us the product in question.
Ms. Norris, let me see if I understand the facts. Put the law aside for the moment. You sold, your client sold resin, two batches of resin to Plastex. Plastex middleman sold it to Fiberet. Whatever resin you sold, either batch A or batch B, there was evidence in the record that it was a defect or something was wrong with it.
No, Your Honor, that's exactly what was not shown. We sold hundreds of batches of resin to Plastex. Hundreds of batches, not types of resin, batches of resin. We sold two types, at least two types.
Whatever you sold, was there some evidence the jury could find that it was defective?
No, Your Honor, there was none. For example, and I want to take issue right here, as Justice Spears mentioned in an earlier argument that I was sitting in on, the issue is joined regarding Mr. Yarborough's testimony as to what was wrong with the delamination. You'll look in the statement of facts on pages 125 through 127. Mr. Yarborough says, well, I tell you what was wrong with that resin, that on all those pools that delaminated, of course, we don't know which batches they were. It was excessive wax. He says, well, there was excessive wax in that resin. If you look on pages 125 through 127, I asked him, how much wax was in that resin, sir? I don't know. Well, how much wax is excessive? I don't know. I'm not a chemist. Well, did you run any tests on the resin that was used in those pools that delaminated? No.
Who's the jury? Did the jury believe it?
Well, Your Honor, I can't
tell
you.
Who won the jury verdict? Did the jury believe that testimony?
Your Honor, I can't tell you whether or not the jury believes Mr. Yarborough or not.
Well, the jury believed some experts for the plaintiff because they answered some jury issues favorable to them for them to get inducted.
I don't know if they believed anybody or if they were confused, Your Honor. And maybe that was my fault. Your Honor, the plaintiff's own expert, Warren Erickson, testified, and I put that in the record, too. That was before the jury. Mr. Erickson, can you tell me where the defect is in any of these batches? And he said, no, Ms. Norris, I cannot tell you where the defect is. Can you tell me which batch of these caused the delamination? No, I can't tell you that. Their own witnesses admitted that. Now, we're kind of sliding into the second point, which is the pool standard. And I did want to make the one last point before I go into the second point of error, and that's there's no way you could know what was unfit about that resin at the time it left U.S. Steel, because you don't know what the resin was, which batch it was. You don't know how it was unfit because of all the evidence of intervening causes. That slides us really into the second point of error.
Before you slide too far, let me ask you, is there any evidence in the record that this resin came to Fiberex in anything but an untampered original container from U.S. Steel?
No, Your Honor, there is no evidence to dispute that. However, that does raise one other issue that I would like to join with Mr. Holman, and that is his broad statement that there is evidence in the record that Fiberex received some of every batch that Plastex received. Well, I'm sorry, Your Honors, that is just not the truth. If you look on Statement of Facts, pages 474 through 479, I was cross-examining Mr. Terry Smith, who is the president of Plastex. And on direct examination, he had admitted, yeah, he said, Fiberex received some of every batch that Plastex received. On cross-examination, I took him through each and every one of those invoices that went from U.S. Steel to Plastex, and then the invoices went from Plastex to U.S. Steel. There is at least a 30-day period in there, September 15th through October 15th, where Plastex received resin from U.S. Steel, but that resin did not follow on down to Fiberex. So that just points up to all of these gray areas, these murky areas that we have no idea what really happened as in the evidence as it stands. Now, the Court of Appeals set out all the evidence at trial. If the court will look, and I only have references to the slip opinion. I don't have the Southwest reporter. If you look on pages 25 through 32, the Court of Appeals carefully sets out, in a summary fashion, all of the evidence that was presented at trial. If you look on page 7, in fact, that's in the section of the opinion in which the Court of Appeals even said, FiberX is evidence, or something like that, and they specifically said, FiberX said that it applied the resin correctly. Well, of course, U.S. Steel said no, they didn't. In any event, all you had were possible causes of the delamination. Not a single witness ever said this was, in all probability, this was the cause. The list of 12 items, they mentioned that in, FiberX mentions that in their brief. The list of 12 items causes by the Court of Appeals. When I read FiberX's brief, I thought that they were saying that the Court of Appeals sat there and came up with 12 ideas on how pools could delaminate, and then FiberX said, but we showed that none of these occurred except for two of them. Well, that's not what the Court of Appeals did. The Court of Appeals went through the testimony, went through the statement of facts, and picked out the 12 possible causes of delamination as testified to by all the witnesses in the trial. It's everybody's evidence, not just FiberX's. In looking at the pool standard and the argument, I think that what FiberX has done is that they have, shall we say, glommed, to use a non-legal word, glommed onto Justice Marshall's penultimate paragraph in the Cropper case. Because in the penultimate paragraph, I believe it was there that Justice Marshall said, but now the plaintiff has come in and said that there was all sorts of evidence that was not referred to in the Court of Appeals decision, so we're going to remand it back to the Court of Appeals to consider that.
Which case?
I believe that was in the Cropper case.
Are you talking about Cropper versus Caterpillar?
Yes, Your Honor.
Marshall?
Well, then it might have been the other one that was decided on the same day.
There's no Marshall.
We don't have a Marshall on our court.
Well, I apologize, and I can check on that. My notes said Marshall, and I came up with the wrong name. I do apologize, but the point was.
No, our court has experienced some instability in terms of makeup, but there's been no Marshall against.
It's wrong court. There's one.
No, it was I remember correctly that it was the Crocker. That was it, Your Honor. I apologize. In that opinion, Justice Wallace said, now the plaintiff has come in with all this new evidence, we've got to send it back so that they can consider it again. That's what FiberX is trying to argue to this court today. But the Court of Appeals just considered all this evidence. And if you look at the Court of Appeals opinion very carefully, they carefully laid down both sides, back and forth, back and forth. What has happened, and I know I do have the right name on this one, is that if the court were to decide that the Court of Appeals did not follow Poole, then Justice Gonzalez's prophecy is going to come about. You're going to have a Court of Appeals that is going to transcribe the entire statement of facts, in order to comply with Poole. In this case, we've got 5 volumes of statements of fact.
Whether it's Poole or what case, you don't contend what's in footnote 2 possibly be correct.
I'm sorry, footnote 2. Was that the footnote you all were...
31.
Was that the footnote that you all were referring, you and Mr. Holman were referring to about insufficiency?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm confused, but I thought that footnote 2 referred not to the no evidence points of error, which were points 1 and 4. I thought it referred to... factual insufficiency,
well,
Your Honor, which
factual
were...
factual insufficiency.
Those were not no evidence points, Your Honor. I thought that those were referring to insufficiency of the evidence. And the court, I believe, correctly sets out the standard in the body of its opinion, and not only disregarding the footnote, the court acted appropriately.
Well, more precisely, an insufficient evidence point, and that's factual insufficiency, requires only considerations of the evidence tending to support a fact. Now that is simply not the law.
Your Honor, all I can say is that I believe that the Court of Appeals correctly stated the law in the body of its opinion. It correctly applied the law, and you'll note, however, that factual insufficiency was not the only point of error that was granted and was the basis of their reversal and remand, but so was the greater weight and preponderance of the evidence.
Well, I know greater weight. I don't want to take up your time, but greater weight to me has to do when the jury fails to find a preponderance of the evidence, whereas insufficiency goes when the jury's answer is not supported by sufficient evidence. Now that, to me, is a distinction. Do you place some other distinction on it?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the majority opinion in the Cropper versus Caterpillar case did place a different distinction on how the greater weight and preponderance. It wasn't necessarily a failure of the jury to find, but it could also include the jury making a finding that was against the greater weight and preponderance of the evidence. I do want to address real briefly, because I do have to address both applications in my 30 minutes without the benefit of rebuttal time, Plastex's appeal. I thought that when reading Plastex's brief, that it admitted that it was not entitled to attorney's fees if the trial court's verdict regarding the DTPA, if the appellate court's reversal of the trial court's verdict was affirmed. So therefore, I would think that their point of error number two regarding reversal is irrelevant at this time. However, their argument today seemed to indicate differently. If you look at their attorney's fees were awarded by a jury's issue with regard to reasonable and necessary attorney's fees incurred in this cause of action. Now, if we have to go back and retry the case and say for some reason Fiberex recovered again, I don't believe that Plastex is entitled to receive those attorney's fees that it received by another jury in another trial, because that trial's verdict was reversed and remanded. The second point of error that they have forwarded, which is point of error number one, says, they say, don't send us back down there. Let us just hang out here until, and let Fiberex and U.S. Steel go down and fight it out. Mr. Higgins failed to remind the court that Plastex has a cross-claim against U.S. Steel. He keeps pointing to the fact that Fiberex and Plastex have all finished off their battle. Well, Plastex and U.S. Steel have a battle to go to, because they have a cross-claim that is asserted against U.S. Steel in the case, and therefore the rights of all the parties are intertwined. Plastex has made a claim against U.S. Steel. There's no indication that Plastex is going to withdraw that claim, and they should have to go back down to the trial court as the Court of Appeals has ordered. In sum, U.S. Steel Corporation would assert that this court should leave the well-thought decision of the Dallas Court of Appeals alone. Fiberex is not denied its right to trial as a result of the Court of Appeals decision. They get to go back down, and they do get their right to trial. They get their constitutional right. U.S. Steel is not denied the right to demand, however, that a party alleging serious claims about a product's condition at the time it left U.S. Steel was unfit. U.S. Steel is not denied the right to demand that that party prove it by the preponderance of the evidence. So respectfully, we would request that the Court of Appeals, that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision.
Counsel, if Plastex has to relitigate its attorney's fees, don't you think they'll ask for some more?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that they can recover attorney's fees in a separate case that has been reversed and remanded. I believe that they could, if they go back down, they can ask for attorney's fees for that case that they have to go back down for.
But their attorney's fees are based upon the DTPA, which says in its inception, this act shall be liberally applied to promote its underlying purposes. Are there any cases on point on that specific issue that you just raised on attorney's fees under the DTPA?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay,
I
didn't know of any, and so.
But, Your Honor, I believe that the very fact that they say that it should be liberally applied does not mean that even where U.S. Steel is not found liable for DTPA causes of action, that they have in a specific trial that they have to pay those attorney's fees to a co-defendant.
If they don't recover against you under the DTPA, I don't think there are attorney's fees.
I think that's true, Your Honor, and the only fact-finding that they have to base their attorney's fees on is a jury issue that refers to fair and reasonable attorney's fees in this cause of action, incurred by the party in defending this cause of action. This cause of action was that lower court decision that has been reversed and remanded, and that we believe should be reversed and remanded. They don't have a fact-finding of attorney's fees in that new case.
But if they have to go back and try it again, you're saying they could not add new attorney's fees to those previously incurred?
Your Honor, I don't believe that they can go, that they can recover those attorney's fees incurred with result to just the trial of the lower court's opinion. They can ask for attorney's fees involved in the new trial, and quite frankly, I'm not sure that I could successfully argue that they could keep out all of the discovery that was incurred up to the point of the new trial, but for those 8 days that we were in trial, I don't think that they would be entitled to those attorney's fees.
I understand.
Any further questions? Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, the counsel spent 30 minutes pointing out conflicts in the evidence to this court. But as I understand the rules of review and appeal, those conflicts are supposed to be resolved in favor of the party that has the jury verdict. But that's not what was done in this case. Instead, whenever the defendant, U.S. Steel, raises a conflict, the court presumes that that's the correct evidence and disregards the evidence presented by the plaintiff that supports the jury verdict. That's not how the case is supposed to be reviewed.
Can you give me a brief summary of what witnesses testified that the resin was defective, whether it's batch A, B, or C?
Your Honor, first of all, everything that came from U.S. Steel that went into build, came from U.S. Steel to build this pool. It was received in sealed drums. Each batch will produce I don't know how many numbers of drums, but a lot of them. But it takes more than one barrel to make a pool. And one pool may be made out of one batch or several batches.
I don't care what. That's right. My question is, give me the names of the witnesses that testified that the resin was defective.
Mr. Yarbrough did. He testified that, in his opinion, it was defective. But that goes to the reason why it was defective. He was pressed on examination, both direct and cross. Why do you think it laminated? He said, I believe because it was excessive wax was in the resin. No, I can't tell you how much, but that's the result of coming apart. It's the same way that this pool comes off the mold. We put wax in the mold so it'll come off the mold. And it's delaminating just like it's coming off a mold. It looks like to me too much wax got into this resin. We couldn't scientifically prove it, but we proved it circumstantially. But the point before this...
Anybody else besides Mr. Yarbrough?
Mr. Yarbrough, no one was willing to take a position one way or the other. All the other experts said, I don't know.
Wasn't that your burden? To show a defect?
No, sir. But we did. But we didn't have that burden. What we had to prove is that it didn't work as it was warranted. It was not fit for its ordinary purpose to bind them together. Now, when you read these opinions that are going to come in these post-submission briefs, what you're going to find is the court refers to breach of warranty as making it defective. In other words, when it doesn't perform what it's intended to do, that makes it defective. But why is it defective? You don't have to prove why. You don't have to point out the specific element that makes it defective. In other words, does a housemaker, when she buys a blender and brings it back and she turns it on and it whirs and it doesn't work, does she have to come into court with an expert witness to prove why that blender didn't work? No, she doesn't have to do that. Now, if the one
all she has to show it doesn't work, and you're being challenged, and the representations that have been made here that you, besides Mr. Yarbrough, which was severely damaged on cross, there are no witnesses that said the resin was defective.
Well, I didn't understand. Really damaged on cross?
Yes. Well, he admitted that he could not that he had performed no tests, done no experiments,
did no scientific proof. Well, obviously, Your Honor, that's something that impeaches his testimony. But that doesn't mean the jury can't still believe him. Why can't he be believed? Because he's not a scientist? Because he's not trained?
All right. Assuming the jury believed him. Now, the jury, the Court of Appeals said this meager evidence against their, because of this meager state of the evidence, this finding of the jury is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence.
But no one took a contrary position. All they said was they didn't know one way or the other. Mr. Yarbrough was the only witness that took a position on it. But aside from the direct proof of that, it's the circumstances that also prove it, because you have two things that can cause this to happen. It could either be a defect, whatever it is, in the resin, or the way you put it together. It's one of those two things. And all the witnesses in the opinion agreed that that's what it was, one of those two things. We spent 2.5 weeks in trial proving it wasn't the application that did it. Now, the inference you draw, and it's only one inference, is that it was the resin, something in the resin. But what U.S. Steel wants this court to hold and establish for breach warranty cases in this jurisdiction, as well as products, because it's going to be interpreted that way in products cases too, is that you have to prove why. You have to show why it didn't work.
If you went back for a new trial, how could you prove?
I can't. See, the resin, it changes over the course of time. Even sitting there without the catalyst in it, it'll alter and change. And then once you put the catalyst in it, it undergoes a chemical reaction. There's no way. Now, if there were a way, U.S. Steel had the opportunity. They came to the plant. They got a sample of the resin from one of the delaminated pools and took it back with them. And they sent it to an independent lab for analysis, and the results were lost. So neither side could come in and tell the jury why.
How convenient.
Well, that happened.
Were lost?
Yeah, it was lost. Well, that was the explanation was given. But in any event, the point is no one could say precisely why. But that's not the burden for either side. It's the circumstances that can decide the case. The court, in its opinion, said you don't have to offer scientific proof of what the defect is. They recognize that. But what they... The way they reached the result is to disregard the evidence that supported the jury's verdict. Now, I want to go back to the thing about the batches and the two different kinds of resin. As I pointed out earlier, all the resin that was used to make pools came from U.S. Steel in sealed containers, no alteration. And it was proven conclusively that it was not altered until it got into our hands and we used it. Now, the delamination occurred sometimes right after they got through applying it. It would occur in their plant, or later it would appear after it was put in the ground and used by others. But the fact remains is that it came to us in an unaltered situation. We used it properly, and it didn't work.
Now, what evidence is there that you used properly?
Your Honor, I'd have to cite you.
Is it in the record?
Yeah, it's all through the statement of facts. I'll give you some specific examples.
That's not necessary.
You were attempting, you know, their Exhibit C, which is Defendant's Exhibit 2, is the technical data on the resin. So you were attempting to put on evidence to show that you had complied with the technical specifications for application?
Well, that was one of the points in contention in the trial. That technical data sheet is a suggestion of how you should adjust the catalyst to make it work properly in terms of spraying it up there so it'll stick. In other words, if you don't have the right viscosity, it'll just run off like water. It's got to be thick enough to stay where you spray it. It doesn't have anything to do with whether or not it's going to bond. And that's a red herring. It doesn't have anything to do with the real issue in the case is whether or not it bonded these two layers together.
Well, one of the sections is labeled curing properties. And curing properties, I just interpreted that to mean bonding time.
No. Curing means how fast it gets hard. In other words, most of the pools are laid up while the first layer is still wet to some extent. It hadn't completely hardened. But as it hardens, it becomes more and more unworkable. So in the process of making a very big part that has several sections and several layers to it, you need to know how fast it's going to become completely hard so you can work the product as you're making it. But hardness, if it gets completely hard, and it's got wax on the surface, can lead to poor bonding. The evidence is that the application process was mostly wet on wet. In a few areas, there was some wet on dry, but it wasn't over a 24-hour period. It hadn't gotten so hard that it shouldn't bond. And even after it gets completely hard, it still should stick a little bit.